There's a new Apple event in just a few days, it sort of, turns out.
Kind of, yeah.
You gonna go to this, Mayo?
Oh, totally.
It's about apps. You like apps?
Yeah, I do like apps.
You make apps.
My favorite apps and games of 2019.
Yeah, that's event-worthy. This was a weird one, and it seems to be that there's more to it than just like what happened. So the first thing we hear about of this special event in New York City on December the 2nd came by way of a CNBC report, and then we saw as like, this is the thing that's happening. We're just like, what? Whoa, okay. And actually, that wasn't even the first mention of it. We saw a tip about it in our tips inbox, but it was so, you know, it was one of those like vague things that you just couldn't run a story on, probably. And it also seemed like by what they meant by the tip was that this would be like a media only private sort of thing, like with the MacBook Pro, you know, like briefings, but even more obscure.
It might still be that.
Yeah, and it seems to be that. And we saw what Lance, what's his last name?
Ulanoff,
yeah. He used to be at Mashable, and he's since been solo, and then I think he works for LifeWire now is the site. And he tweeted out the image, so we had the CNBC report as like, this is happening from CNBC. I think the guy's name on Twitter is Robo Todd. I think it's like Todd Hassel something. I don't know. But anyway, it's like, okay, CNBC says so. Lance says so. There's an image of the invitation that we see. And, you know, we run the story, obviously. And then more information comes out, like in part by it had like a there's like an image of a golden App Store icon. It looks kind of like a coin or an award, like an achievement. It probably, you know, makes sense. Loved by millions, created by the best is the tagline for the event. And then it says, "Join us for an Apple special event honoring our favorite apps and games of 2019." And Mayo, this is something that they do every year, right? They have this like year in review as like like a developer news release. It's not an event like this, but
yeah, they do like a press release for it because it's, you know, like promotion heading into the holidays,
and it's in the
app store. App store stories on it, and it'll just have like they'll pick some trends of the year, and then they'll pick some best apps and best games, and they just have a list of like 20 titles that they talk about a little bit,
yeah,
and that's it. But they don't, at least as far as we know, they haven't done this before where they invite press to something.
Or even developers. I don't know if developers are going, but I think so, right? But
I'd assume,
yeah.
If you are being honored, if you're one of the honored favorite apps and games, yeah, they'll invite the developers of those games to come along. Because at first it seemed like an actual event where they were going to stream it, but right, you know, in the days since, it seems like that's not going to happen.
It's not been acknowledged by Apple and like any other special event. It's what they call them, as special events every single time. They're all special to us, but they always show up as like a tile on apple.com, and there's like an apple.com/apple-events page, and this hasn't made it there yet. And then there was one really interesting tweet, which was a reply from someone who I don't know who they are, but they are replying to Lance's tweet, and they are like, "You forgot the part where it says don't share this on social media yet," from the email. And yeah, so it sounds like it wasn't supposed to be announced to publicly, just a thing that people were supposed to go to, and then there'd be stories about it afterwards.
Yeah, I think what they're trying to have is a briefing for press where they can talk about apps and games and set up like meetings with the developers that made them, so they can talk about how good, you know, their games run on the iPhone and the iPad, and
which that is like it's a better version of what they've already been doing, and it makes perfect sense to do that. And it sounds like the press is, well, we don't know who else has been invited, but at least
I'm assuming like YouTubers would be going and stuff like that.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that maybe you wouldn't travel across the country for unless you're already in town. But that if you're in the New York City area, then it's like come stop by for this day that we're doing this thing.
So then on the day after the 2nd, so the 3rd. That'll probably be the day when they release the press releases with the list of apps, and they'll obviously time the embargo, so all these like hands-on videos and chats and interviews go live at the same time. I think that's what this is. It's going to be, you know, a short presentation where they talk about the apps, they get some of the developers to talk on you know, a private stage, so it's not video streamed online or anything, and then they go and, you know, arrange press interviews with everybody, and so they can get some promotion for your game if you're one of the, or app if you're one of the people involved. Apple can obviously get promotion for its platform, and no doubt there'll be some emphasis on like Apple Arcade and stuff like that as well. Like, obviously it's not a consumer product event.
Yeah, we think there's a 105% chance that they won't show off a new Apple TV and AirTag device trackers, right?
Yeah, and like some people are like, oh, it's going to be the Mac Pro Day. I don't know where that came from, but that's, you know, rubbish as well.
That's worse than when people associated the Final Cut Pro Summit with Mac Pro information.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We got a Mac Pro Day this week that we won't really talk about, but...
December.
Yeah. No, I mean like the Texas tour, factory tour.
Oh, but, yeah, that was a palaver.
Yeah. You see the packaging? No, that was part of it. It was like they had a poster about...
It just kind of looked like a box.
Yeah, there was the John Gruber talk show mentioned about how someone from Apple told him that it would be like the world's most revolutionary packaging on the planet. And then they even had like and it's like an exaggeration, but not too much of one. And then they even had like a poster slide, like when you walk into an Apple store and they've got like the promotions for the trade-in stuff and all that. But it was about the packaging and it explained what was good about it. And I think it's mostly like the materials, like it's good for the earth. And it's not that it's some like throwback to like VIP concierge level like fancy packaging that someone delivers.
Well, when obviously Gruber said it in June, I immediately thought of like the iMac packaging, which is that weird shape, isn't it? It's like that weird, you know, that weird like convex triangle that if you get like 18 of them, you can make a ring out of them and roll them around. And that's like a weird shape for packaging. So when he said there's going to be some insane packaging, I was thinking along those lines. But what we saw in the factory is that it basically just like looks like a box with recycled materials more than perhaps Apple's used before, which is fine, right, for energy, you know, and helping the planet, but it's not quite insane or as amazing as it was hyped up to be.
Yeah, what the sign says is groundbreaking packaging design. That's the title of the slide or the poster board. And then they say 90% wood fiber, all of which is recycled or from responsibly managed forest.
Isn't wood fiber paper?
Yeah, I think so. Layers of paper create an innovative honeycomb wave structure to protect the Mac Pro during shipment. So
okay. I'm sorry. There's definitely been other packing boxes that have like an internal honeycomb shape to hold stuff in place.
So what's the difference is that they're not using... They haven't used styrofoam in a while, have they? That I know
of. No, they've gone to like plastic and paper on loads of stuff before. I don't get it, but whatever.
Well, honeycomb. I guess you can put your Apple Watch apps in the honeycomb when you're done. Anyway, so let's do a little pivot here. One thing I want to say is this kind of Apple event is not for the year in review sort of thing, but like they do honor best in design at WWDC, don't they? And they've had that streamed as part of like the experience, you know, and they have like an award ceremony. And the one year they just gave out the honors without having an event for it, which was weird. Then they brought it back. So this is like that, but its own thing separate from WWDC. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's very similar to like Apple Developer Awards, but in the fall. And here we go.
You're in review content, indeed. And speaking of WWDC, there is an app update this week for the WWDC app in which the app is renamed to the Apple Developer app, which it makes sense in a lot of places. I'm curious about what you think this could mean. Just from my observations, I saw it change on the Apple TV as well, and that's always been like the watch the keynote live streamed app. And now it always had like special artwork for the event, and now it's this. It's a really cool icon of like the App Store and of like a blueprint sort of sense. And you've also got the you've got the App Store icon for the App Store. For App Store Connect, which used to be iTunes Connect, you've got like the inverted colors of that. Instead of like white on blue, it's blue on white. So it's meant like behind the scenes. And then this is like blueprint before you even get there.
It's a nice icon.
It is a nice icon. It's not a white icon, so it's nice. But then I'm curious, are they going to use that for the event of WWDC and have his own branding every year? Is it like, this is what it is? And then they point you to the Apple TV app to live stream the event in the future. Like we've already seen them do now, where you could do it in both places. But now maybe they won't do it in an Apple developer app, or they will do it, but not without the custom theme every year.
Yeah. So if you open the developer app now, you see four tabs, which is Discover, which is like a news feed, videos, which is all the past videos from WWDC, and then you have a WWDC tab, which is like the session schedule, but obviously there's no, you know, the 2020 schedule isn't on there yet, so it's just kind of blank or showing you last year's schedule. And then you have like the account page where you can log in. Because one of the features of this is you can sign up to the Apple Developer Program using an auto-renewable subscription, whereas you used to have to go through the website, but now you can do like, you know, through the phone billing
mm-hmm.
thing. So what it seems like from the current design of the app is that all the WWDC stuff, when, you know, the event's happening, will be funneled into that third tab, and maybe we won't see the theming that we've seen in previous years.
Mm-hmm.
And it supports like light and dark mode, whereas the old app never did. The thing that one thing that's most interesting is that TechCrunch had like a little embargo exclusive where obviously Apple had told them a bit more of the intentions of the application, and they said that Apple will be rolling more and more content into the developer app, spanning all of its documentation. And obviously recently there's been some criticism that Apple's documentation has not been very good lately. It's sparse, stuff's missing, or it's hard to find. And apparently one of their ways to address that is going to funnel everything into the developer app. As a developer, I will say, while it is nice that they're, you know, committing to documentation, I want it on a website, not inside of a phone app. Just putting it out there. And at least right now, they did not release it on the Mac. So yeah. If they're going to shove, like, the Apple documentation on the website, even if it is sparse today, there's so much of it that it requires, like, Google searches to find the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You do not want it all funneled and made exclusive inside an app, which right now has no organization at all. Like, it has the news feed is literally just a reverse chronological list that you just scroll. So mm-hmm. there's no hierarchy or anything at the moment. So maybe when they start putting more documentation in there, they'll, like, flesh it out a bit. But even so, if they're not, they need to at least do a Catalyst version so it can be on the Mac. And ideally, I don't want them taking it off the web. So that's a bit of a warning flag, but we'll have to wait and see how that continues.
Mm.
The other part of this is, are they going to rename the conference? Because the app's obviously changed from WWDC to developer. And right now, they have a tab, which is WWDC. But if they were going to rename the conference, they would change the tab, you know, when they announced WWDC 2020.
Yeah.
I don't have much, like, sentimental value to the WWDC name. I think it's, you know, it's a very long name for, like, and it's kind of stupid that it takes more syllables to do the acronym than it does just to say Worldwide Developers Conference.
Yeah.
If they change it to Apple Developer Conference, then so be it. And it'd be fine, and everyone just carry on with their lives. And they'd probably just change the tab to, like, conference rather than saying WWDC.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'd be fine, but I wouldn't say that that's necessary a hallmark of them renaming this app. They clearly are trying to appease developers a bit more with the documentation stuff, a more centralized place for all the video content, and the, like, account management stuff, which is currently only available in the US. So as my developer account, I can't, like, log into it at the moment because it's UK, but this would be expanding to other countries in the coming months.
Okay. Well, the no Mac app thing, I mean, they didn't have a WWDC app for the Mac before. Our colleague Guy Rambo has made an unofficial one that has sufficed all this time. But they've relied on the website before now. I would guess that the website remains like the source of the information, and it's just also available through the app. And then maybe they do like a Catalyst version of the iPad app for the Mac, but then the website is still the source where, like, they're getting the material from. The ability to pay for your developer account through an in-app purchase, that kind of lets you do that. It saves some money on your account because you often see these $85 gift cards for $100 of App Store credit. And so if you apply that to your account on the time that your account renews, then you could save 50% on your account, which is not bad. The conference renaming idea, WWDC, yeah, I mean, they've had dozens of these conferences under that name. We don't really count the number, just the year that we're in, but worldwide, if we're analyzing this, you know, not that it's a problem, but if you're going to take a look at it now, then worldwide can sound dated because everything is worldwide, including Beats One. But it's sort of like World Wide Web, World Wide Developers Conference, you know, and just saying Apple Developer Conference is more descriptive.
That dates the name, because the reason it was called WWDC in the first place is because it was back when Apple had basically no presence in the wider world because they made Macs and iPods and nothing else.
Yeah.
And then even in, like, and obviously WWDC is pre-2000s. Like, I'm pretty sure it was called WWDC when Jobs was kicked out. So it goes back a long, long time, that name.
Yeah.
And they don't no longer, you know, everyone knows who Apple is these days. They don't need to tell you that it's worldwide and open to everyone.
Yeah. So I am a fan of ADC, the Apple Developer Conference, even though there's affection for DubDub, as in the short version of WWDC. And they've even made, like, the sticker pack, you know, sticker for DubDub is like a thing. And they use it on, like, the theme last year as part of the material. And that can still be like an insider, you know, throwback reference back to when it used to be called WWDC. But it's gone through enough changes now for moving from Moscone back to San Jose. And so many number of years, and just and then more modernization in terms of, like, putting out content through a live stream or very quickly with transcriptions, where before, a few years ago, the videos would come, like, weeks later, if ever. I think it's all could, like, add up to this. This is now the Apple Developer Conference. And just say Apple to mean all the things that it covers, which is much more than just the Mac, as it were. I'm a fan of that. Do you think that this has, that having an Apple developer app, even if it is just rebranded of WWDC app, if it could have any, you know, preview of, like, what would happen if Apple did a version of Xcode on the iPad? And you could do something with that, you know, develop an app from the iPad, submit it, and never interact with a Mac, or is this strictly just rebranding the WWDC app to you?
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear if you look at the layout of it, it's at the moment at least just a rebranding of the WWDC app with, like, an extra tab for, you know, general news essentially. Xcode on the iPad is a complicated subject. Swift Playgrounds was the closest we got to really seeing Apple software development come to iOS.
Yeah.
And, you know, no offense to the Swift Playgrounds team, it hasn't changed much since the 4 years it's been out there. So I don't think they're, like, actively rushing to build that stuff up, because, you know, having a full IDE environment on the iPad is complicated for many different reasons. Like, yes, you can get Xcode on there, but then there's so many, like, accompanying tools that making an app requires anyway, that just beyond the build system and Xcode itself. So I think it'd be nice if you could make, like, little apps on the iPad eventually, but I'm surprised they haven't pushed, like, Swift Playgrounds more in that direction more aggressively. Like, all they've done with Swift Playgrounds is add new materials, add different interactions. Like, they added the, you know, augmented reality and the robots control stuff, but it's still, like, a split screen. You type code on the left, you see the output on the right. Like, it doesn't have the sophistication that making an app would actually need. The only thing I would say there is that maybe they were waiting on the Swift UI framework to be released and come out.
Mm-hmm.
So then when they do, you know, like, quote unquote Xcode for iPad, even though they didn't call it that, it could just focus on Swift UI development only, right? And be optimized for that, and could ignore a lot of the legacy that would come with supporting the entire of, like, Objective-C and Swift and this storyboards and all of that gump. Like, if they did something where you could just, you know, even if it was just making your UI layouts on the iPad using Swift UI, and then you actually just took that to your Mac to do, like, the code side of the work, right? Not just, like, the interface. I could see them do that. But I wouldn't put any, I'd say the renaming of this app has no influence on that either way.
This week, I'm so happy to announce a new sponsor for 9to5 Mac Happy Hour called BitsBox. That's BitsBox. Benjamin and I just wrapped up discussing Apple's developer conference and the idea of coding on the iPad. And you may have guessed that Benjamin is a developer, but I am not. But that doesn't mean my kids can't learn to code, thanks to BitsBox. BitsBox is an amazing service designed for kids aged 6 to 12 that sends you and your kids a special binder called the Apper Keeper, and inside you'll find easy-to-understand cards with fun subjects like animals and other characters. BitsBox is a monthly subscription, so every month your child will receive new material for projects, and if your kids are like mine, they love to get mail of their own. simply type in a four-digit code on the BitsBox website, then follow the instructions on the card for building fun and interactive apps that run on a virtual tablet in the web browser. Now, I can't stress enough that I am not a programmer, and I admit I was a bit intimidated when I thought about helping my daughter learn to code on her own, but BitsBox makes learning to program extremely approachable with projects that are quick to complete and even physical stickers that your child can use to mark off completed projects in their Apper Keeper. And my daughter loves stickers, so it really is cool. All BitsBox requires is a computer with a keyboard and the internet. BitsBox notes that the coding part of the experience isn't meant to be done on tablets just yet, but you can totally play with the completed app on a phone or tablet after coding from a computer. And I'll share a tip here. My daughter has the new entry-level iPad and Apple Smart Keyboard. So I just had to test the new desktop class version of Safari on the iPad, and guess what? It totally works, exactly like on my Mac. In our experience, typing on the iPad Smart Keyboard was as easy as using my Mac, which I love. So if you're like me and want your kids to go even further than you with technology, BitsBox is a fantastic way to get started and use iPads and Macs for more than just playing games and watching videos. Our listeners can get $25 off any BitsBox subscription of $50 or more by going to bitsbox.com/happyhour and at checkout, enter promo code happyhour. That's $25 off plus free shipping at bitsbox.com/happyhour and use code happyhour for this exclusive offer. Order BitsBox today. Your kids will love coding and you'll gift them with an important skill that's necessary for a successful future. All right, Mayo, and something else this news this week that was not totally surprising but was exciting nonetheless is the release of Apple Smart Battery Cases for the iPhone 11, iPhone 11 Pro, and iPhone 11 Pro Max. And the reason this doesn't catch us off guard is because, you know, one, they've made a few versions of these now over the years. They only skipped for the iPhone 10 since they've made these, if I recall correctly. Maybe the 8 didn't work in the 7 version, but at any rate, they made versions for the 10s and 10r and 10s Max. Yeah. So it's no surprise that they made one for the 11 family. Plus, join that up with our colleague Guy Rambo finding assets of these things, like what they will look like, you know, just what you imagine. So it's no surprise that they're out. It's just a matter of when. Well, the answer was November 20th. They're out. I don't think they're quite in stores yet, but maybe they're starting to show up. I think some people were quoted next in delivery, and then they got the day after. So by this weekend, people can have these. But there is something different about it this year, which is the inclusion of a new hardware button on the case itself, which connects to the camera in a unique way. And the way Apple describes that is the case features a dedicated camera button that launches the camera app, whether the iPhone is locked or unlocked. So it's got to be powered on from what I can read, but not unlocked. Just like swiping on the lock screen or pressing the little button on the screen. And then a quick press of the button takes a photo, and a longer press captures quick take video. It works for selfies too. So this is only for the 11. The 11 is the phone that has the quick take feature where you can record video by holding your finger down on the shutter button. This is a new version of the battery case with the new camera feature, which I've seen some people say, like, why do you need the battery case anymore? The iPhone 11 battery is really good, especially in the Pro and Max phone. But this kind of the case, I think that button alone sort of answers the question that if you're doing a lot of stuff with photo and especially video, that's still battery intensive. That's still something that Apple doesn't spec high on their battery chart. And they're saying this is sort of the, if you're heavy into photography and videography, then this is for you.
Yeah, like it's definitely a nice value add to have the camera button in addition to the battery life, because you know, this is easily the iPhone generation that least needs a battery case. Mm-hmm. Because they made the inbuilt battery so much better. Obviously, there are still use cases where people are using their phones very, very intensively, and a lot of those involve, you know, photography and video work. So putting those things together is a nice touch. And it's kind of funny because a lot, like for a few years, people wanted Apple to put, you know, a physical camera button on the phones, and they never showed any interest in doing that, even though like some of the Android competition does do that. But now they've put it on their cases. The old XS cases would basically double the battery life of the phone because the batteries were like 80-90% capacity of what the internal battery was, right? These do not seem to have be quite the same level because obviously the internal batteries of the phones have got bigger. I don't think that they've actually increased the batteries in the battery case by the same amount.
Mm-hmm.
So what it says on the product description is that you'll get up to 50% more battery when you're using the case. So you're basically getting half extra. So the 11 Pro Max is rated for 17 hours wireless video. And so if these cases were like the XS series, you'd be getting another 17 hours on top. So you get 34 or close to that, right? Like 32. And so what Apple's quoting here, that we'll obviously have to test when they come for real, but what based on Apple's description, you'll be getting an extra like 8 hours on the 17, so like 26 hours basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, when you've got 26 hours of battery life, you're really going to struggle to burn that all in one day. Mm-hmm. But there are definitely people who can go through the Pro Max battery life in one day. Not like for an average day, but if you're, you know, if you're at a theme park and you're taking video constantly, or, you know, you're on location taking photo after photo after photo, like especially 4K for video recording, that uses a lot of power. Or augmented reality stuff like Pokemon Go trips, they still use a lot of battery because you're running AR, you're running the GPS. So everyone is obviously welcomed with open arms the battery life improvements on the 11 Pro, and the need for the battery cases are definitely more marginalized. Like for me, when I had the iPhone X, I wanted a battery case. Now with the 11 Pro, I'm not interested in the battery case at all. Like I just, my battery's fine, but there, I'm not oblivious to the segment of the market, however small, much smaller it is now, that does actually benefit from having these cases available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So before they did, well, they're the same price as last time, which is the same price for each phone case, $129, right? And yeah. That was a bit of a surprise that we thought it might have been more than that and different between case sizes, but it's $129 across the board. They've been black and white like last time, but they've also included a pink sand from the start. Last year, Pink Sand joined not too long after the battery cases came out, but not on launch day, and we didn't know it was coming. So now they've got the three colors. The first thing I thought was, whoa, they're not doing a green case, because they do a green silicone case, but not up for the smart battery case, and they could. And so I think if we see something change in the future, I think that will be what changes, that they have the fourth color option, and it will be like, you know, forest kind of green to match, at least for the Pro and Pro Max, you know, at least for those phones that come in the midnight green color option. The one for the 10S was the first that I used. And when I had the Max phone, I tried it with the Max phone. I just did not like it. It felt like a terminal for checkout, like what the Apple Store uses, you know, to scan a credit card, but all the time. But then I tried it for the 10S, not Max, and I was really happy with it and used it every single day until just about whenever I upgraded to the 11, you know, family of phones. So I'm not going to order one this time as soon as they're out, but I am interested in enough that if like someone's like, you know, what do you want for Christmas sort of thing, that I can just like give them a list and this will be on it. Or maybe if, like, you know, I'm in an Apple store one day and I just want to buy something there, then I might pick up one of these just to have it. But the limitation is that it's phone specific. So, you know, you change phones and the form factor changes at all, which we expect it will. And then next year, then these are married to the phone generation that they are. So
yeah, they don't have very long lifespans if you're upgrading your phone every year.
Yeah. So really what I'm saying is I would like to try it, but not own it, not invest in it.
Well, because you did say that you could have used one when you went to like Disneyland, right?
Correct. Yeah. So I have the iPhone 11 Pro Max, and that's got incredible battery life to where I'm very rarely seeing 20% before bedtime. But on that day, it was way out of the ordinary where my phone was on the charge until 8 a.m. But then I was at Disney World using the phone to stream a podcast through the AirPods, or to take pictures, take some video, but not a whole lot, but some, you know, to send messages back and forth. But then I think the most intensive thing I probably did that day was like watch Apple TV Plus, because it was like the first weekend where Apple TV Plus was out, and I was standing in, you know, hour long lines by myself without family there. So it was really convenient just to watch.
You were watching like Sea Gore.
Yeah.
On the queue for like A Small World.
Right. And this was before Disney Plus was out. So I couldn't even, you know, be festive and do that. But yeah, between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m., I was in the red. I don't think my phone ever died before I got back to the car, but I had planned on being there until like 11 p.m. for fireworks, and it would not have lasted that long without finding a charger or bringing a battery along. But I mean, at the end of the day, the best thing to do if you plan on changing phones every year is to have a really good external battery pack, you know,
yeah,
and just keep that and not change the phone case because it's so expensive for what it is.
Yeah, and there are quite a few like external battery packs now that have like integrated Qi chargers in them, so you don't even need cables. Mm-hmm. Like, you just carry around your bag, and if you need to charge up, you can just place your phone on it and carry on.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, I don't know the name of my favorite battery pack, but I often receive the Mophie battery pack for testing, so they're very expensive, you know. So I can't say much about the price, but I've bought like one at a pinch one time, and it was one of those fabric covered ones, and that's actually one I use often. But when you're looking at battery packs, I like to have USB-A as an outlet for a cable to go out, and USB-C as well with power delivery so that you can charge things very fast. And ideally be able to recharge the battery itself with USB-C so that it can be faster than USB-A. So that's the end of the day recommendation. And if it wasn't for this new button on the camera, on the battery case for the camera, then I really wouldn't be interested at all. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's a very small convenience. It's a change this year. But big picture, you know, you can take pictures very quickly from swiping the screen or pressing the lock screen camera button.
And obviously when you're in the camera, you can use the volume buttons to take the shot. So there is a hardware button if you want to.
Yep. And you can hold them down and do quick take video. So it's a very small change. But if this is something that you've been waiting for, you know, I do still play Pokemon Go, me and my mother-in-law and some friends. And so that is something I did at Disney World, which didn't help my battery life. I don't use the AR feature because I think it's harder that way, but it's still, you know, using your GPS all the time. So for those things, it makes sense. But I don't see myself spending the $129 for a few months to have this battery case and then, you know, changing phones inevitably in the year's time. And what I did last year was I sold it. You know, I didn't sell it for the full price, obviously, but I sold it for some money. But not this time. Let's talk a bit about iOS 14 because it's never too soon. Mayo, I believe you covered this story. This is from our friend Mark Gurman at Bloomberg.
This is from Mark Gurman at Bloomberg. Yeah. And what's it about? Nothing else but iOS 13 bugs, because that story is never going away.
No.
Whether you're talking about iOS bugs this year, iOS bugs last year, iOS bugs 2 years ago, it's just the endless cycle. Mm-hmm. We have one iOS release, which is pretty good on features, but then bad for stability, and then we have another iOS release which is good on stability and not so good on features, and then the cycle repeats and repeats and repeats. We were hoping that their kind of internal organization last year for iOS 12 would extend onwards to future OS releases, but clearly it didn't, because the launch of iOS 13 was pretty bad. It's definitely gotten better, and like 13.3 beta, they're pretty fine to be honest, but the 13.0 situation was obviously very bad, and the 13.1 situation was bad, and we've still got some, you know, outlying issues here and there. What Mark Gurman says here is that Federighi's division, obviously he runs Apple software division, they are restructuring the way that they develop and test the operating systems with the goal of improving stability and being flexible enough to be able to cut features at the last minute that are holding back the reliability of the operating system version. So for a little bit of like a history lesson of iOS 13, Bloomberg says that Apple engineers started to realize that iOS 13 would not be up to scratch before June. So heading up to WWDC originally, they were already predicting that the release of iOS 13 in the fall would be less than stellar, which is interesting because that's like a 3-month period. And yet, you know, Apple Inside seems to have awareness of the roadmap pretty well. So they kind of knew by June that this was going to be a problem in September.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously leading up to between August time, Gurman says, and this is like the most damning thing in the story, that Apple engineers gave up on 13.0 and put all attention on 13.1, and Apple pushed aside 13.0 as the update that only diehards would install.
Unless you buy a new phone.
Exactly. For all the brand new owners of the iPhone 11 and iPhone 11 Pro, that was very, very bad. And, like, I know, we obviously tech people upgrade on day one, but there are plenty of normal customers who update on day one as well. It is not limited to diehard users only.
Yeah,
and their original plan in September was that 13.1 would come out on the last day of the month, right? It was coming out on the 30th of September, and then they obviously pushed it forward to the 24th, which did make it less of an issue because then there was only a week where people on the really, really bad 13.0. But you can look at like the mixed panel trends graphs. It's still hitting like 10% adoption rate on 13.0 timeframe. So it is definitely more than just the diehard tech community. So that comment there, if an accurate representation of like Apple's management leadership there, is, you know, pretty bad.
Yeah, I didn't read the full Bloomberg story yet, just what we've got quoted there. But someone sent me a screenshot, a paragraph that mentioned the HomePod situation, which was, you know, it was late, and then it was buggy. You know, they had to do a release a couple of days after the first one, and they pulled the first one. But I think the story says that the watch was okay, and for me that was not true. For a lot of people, it was not true.
Clearly, they had problems across the line, spanning from iOS to Mac to HomePod to everything.
Yeah, and the watch wasn't on Series 1 or 2 for a long time.
Yep.
It was watchless.
And even now, obviously, today, we're still facing a situation where communication limits aren't out, and the iCloud folder sharing stuff was very buggy during the beta season and is being pushed back to the spring. So that's the big overhanging feature that's still unavailable. So what does Bloomberg say Apple's doing to combat this for next year? They say that the reason, well, at least one of the reasons why iOS 13 was so bad, is that engineers were submitting code on a daily basis for like the internal builds of iOS, and that all of the features that were in those internal builds were so conflicting with each other, and at different stages of development, some were nearly done, some were only just getting started, some were in between, that the testing groups, the QA teams, could not get a clear picture of the state of the operating system because they couldn't work out whether one feature was misbehaving because it was just not ready, or if it was being interfered with by the other components that were changing. And they describe it as like, you know, too many cooks all on this one internal build. So what Bloomberg says is changing is that with iOS 14 development, which has apparently already started, which is not unusual because they normally start it around November timeframe, is that the code base is being re-engineered so that more stuff is modularized and can be turned on and off at will. So if theoretically all these different teams are contributing features that are not done, they'll be disabled by default, and then the QA teams can isolate certain issues by turning stuff on and off. Of course, whether that actually makes a difference is a completely different scenario. What it'll probably enable is it'll be more easy for Apple to pull stuff out. Like if they come around to the May timeframe, when they realize it's in a bad shape, they can push more features back more quickly because it was already like compartmentalized. In terms of stopping stuff being buggy, you know, there's so many different factors involved in that. And I'd say only one of them is everything conflicting with each other. Because like you can look at the Mail app, which clearly had big problems in iOS 13. And I'd say it has only just come into like an acceptable state of the 13.3 beta. The problems with the Mail app, I think, could have easily been identified and seen whoever you are inside of Apple, and you don't need like some holistic isolation of features to notice that the Mail app is not loading correctly, the features don't work. Like the moment the Mail app went into beta, right, for developers, the public beta, for the, or, you know, the June beta of iOS 13, there were thousands of people complaining about the Mail app. Like, you know, Apple's QA teams did not need a restructuring of the software development process to notice that the Mail app was bad. and yet the mail app shipped in the state that it did. So I don't take this news as like particularly encouraging in terms of results, but, and of course, we never quite know if this is the full story or what other, you know, there's obviously a lot of nuance here.
It's most certainly probably not the full story, and Apple doesn't talk about it.
Yeah, and it's more complicated than what's described here, right? But at a higher level, I have less confidence in this having any meaningful impact than I did when they had the strategy in iOS 12 of just delaying loads of features and focusing on, and basically setting up all the people that were working on new features were redirected to work on performance and stability only. And it clearly worked last year with iOS 12, right? But for 13, they scrapped that plan and just went to doing what they normally did, and it turned out badly. For 14, turning stuff on and off is not guaranteed to have a perfect result, in my opinion.
Mm, yeah, how long until we get to the thing where they do just gradual releases and don't spend so much time on the marketing number?
Yeah.
It seems like that's where this eventually leads.
Because it is kind of stupid when they have like iOS 12, but, you know, basically no big features associated with it. But they just still call it iOS 12 anyway for the marketing appeal. So they could do that forever, right? Like, they didn't really get any backlash when people announced iOS 12 and it only had, you know, like two or three major features in it and the rest of the performance stability. People just accepted it for what it is and moved on. So even if they are like bundling stuff up for yearly releases, they can just bundle up less stuff, like what they do with iOS 12. Just go at a slower pace and you can get an iOS 12 star result every single time.
Yeah, I often hear the counterpoint that, well, you've got to worry about Android catching up or beating you, and they've, you know. But I don't know what Android's doing anymore. Like, from what I see, they do a conference every year, and some phones get some things, and some things update through their Play Store. But it's not mirrored enough with what Apple does that Apple couldn't change their approach and it'd be a factor. Like, I don't keep up with
and
that.
The,
and I'm techie.
And the high point for like Android and iOS competition is over. Like,
right.
The platforms have matured. Like, back in 2010, 2011, 2012, you know, having a laundry list of features was really important on both sides. And nowadays, it just isn't as relevant anymore. Like, Android definitely has less new features every single year. And so does iOS. Even in the feature patch years, iOS has less major new stuff now than it used to, just because, like, we've covered a lot of the ground basis, right? And a lot of the stuff in iOS 13 is changing stuff that already existed.
Yeah.
And in many ways, changing it for the worse. But so they could 100% slow down. They could do iOS 12 star releases for like the next 3 years and be absolutely fine. They could do like this. iOS 13 could have been like iOS 12, and then the only major new feature was dark mode.
Yeah,
right. And that would have been enough. They didn't have to pack CarPlay, iPad home screen changes, which were kind of minor anyway. Like, shortcuts automations, iCloud folder sharing, communication limits, all this other stuff that I can't remember into one release. Like, nobody would have cared. Like,
do you remember
what we see in reality is a staggered release anyway, because they didn't do a big feature release in iOS 13.0 because they ran out of time or whatever and they had to cut stuff. So even if that's what they wanted to do, they're not achieving it today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a few updates that strike me as memorable that weren't the big releases in years past. And because they were standalone features as part of the update, they're memorable to me. Like, for example, whichever update it was that added night shift, that's the feature where the screen temperature changes before there was true tone.
I believe that was 9.3.
Okay, so that was like a point update. There was theater mode on the Apple Watch, which was a big missing feature, but it wasn't part of 3.0, and I don't think it was part of the announcement. I think it was just like, here's this thing now. And at the time, it was like Dickinson is confused me now. Yeah. Sonny. Yeah. So Sonny was saying that was going to be part of the iPhone, and it was actually part of the watch. So, you know, but like, those features are memorable to me because they were, you know, partly because they were unannounced and they just showed up out of the blue. But then also that they were part of a point update. And so you can sort of categorize where this went with what, and you know, you get there now with iOS updates, but not because it was planned that way, but because features were announced in June and they shipped in November or in some cases May of the next year, like AirPlay 2. And so I think we've, like, at least in the like tech podcast community, we've long been okay with having this is the Apple conference this year, and these are the new features we're working on this year. And you don't even have to announce all of them; just announce like what's going to be coming in September, and then don't do a whole conference for like the point updates, but just release them when they're ready. And we're all like blown away because we didn't know they were coming in the first place. It'd be okay with me. It would sit really well with me, but this isn't that yet. We're still trying to avoid that for some reason.
Yeah, it's still, by the way, it explicitly calls out in this report that Apple still expects iOS 14 to be as feature-packed as iOS 13.
Yeah, if not more. So, and of course, this is just one side of the story, you know, through what Mark can tell. And so I've already seen on online pushback from what's been reported. So we can't tell the other side of the story, whatever it is. But you know, if there's ever anything to share.
Yeah, and they've done the segmentation of feature stuff, like feature flags, for a while.
Yeah.
Maybe they're doing more of it now, but they've definitely done that to some degree before.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so that's the news on iOS 14.
I'll just say one more thing, right?
Yeah.
In iOS 13... what new features are in the Mail app?
They moved the trash can.
Yeah.
The share sheet, the way that you reply and you've got some more actions, they kind of put the share sheet in the Mail app for the first time without having like the action button. But,
yeah, but they made it worse.
Yeah, like, but what's memorable about it is that the trash can's really close to the reply button.
What's memorable about the Mail app in iOS 13 is they made it worse.
Yeah.
Like,
and that's for somebody, like, I didn't experience all the weird stuff where like you were seeing... I do still see sometimes like the count number of the inbox and the actual number of emails is it takes some time to get there. But I usually keep a very low inbox, so it's not a big deal. But yeah, I mean, people have bigger issues than I definitely experience. But for me, I remember is the trash can being bad.
So essentially, the Mail app added no new features, right? Hmm. So why was it buggy? Like, to me, that's like the worst example of the iOS 13 release. Yes, shortcuts automations could come out and be wonky. HomePod, you know, handoff can come out and be wonky. And people don't care as much because they're new features that they didn't rely on and didn't depend on before.
Mm-hmm.
But the stuff that existed before, like the Mail app, right? Like one of the most used apps on the platform, 100%, the app that people use to check their email in. If you're not even going to put new features into it, I don't understand how it regressed so badly.
Well, isn't the actual answer for that is that there's a technical under the hood chain that's supposed to be an improvement, but
yeah, but
it's
that's
a 1.0 version.
That's
of
not
it.
That's not acceptable,
right? Like, customers don't know that.
Yeah, yeah, like it's my theory is that the Mail app was supposed to have new features in it, and that's part of the reason why it was reworked. But they just got delayed or whatever, you know, like, because for a while there was a rumor that they're actually gonna add like snoozing to the Mail app,
that's and true,
like,
yeah,
and weird categorizations, and that never transpired. And so what they've shipped is like a bare bones the existing Mail app with the new underpinnings, which were clearly pretty poor. So at least in my view, what they should have done for 13 is ship the iOS 12 Mail app. Because if they're not going to even try to add new features to it this year, why did they go forward with the rewrite anyway that was clearly bad?
Yeah, and it was okay when iOS 12 had the iOS 11 Mail app for the most part.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I think maybe even the toolbar would make more sense if the new features had actually been available in the iOS 13 release. Like, maybe part of the reason there's this massive gap on the left-hand side is that there were supposed to be buttons there that actually did something.
Yeah, but so email us if you're on the Mail team and let us... put the record straight. I want to talk about HomeKit Secure Video because last week, 1 week ago, it was implemented. So it was released as part of iOS 13.2. So it didn't make 13.01, but made 13.2. And then Logitech released what they call a beta version of firmware for the Logitech Circle 2 wired home security cameras. And these cameras have worked with HomeKit for a long, long time. I've got three of them in total and then two cameras from other manufacturers. I was sent one to test and I bought two of my own because I liked them that much. But then their first two to release HomeKit Secure Video, and at this point, the only people to release HomeKit Secure Video, which fulfills a promise made on like a blog post over the summer that was not really promising. So it's here. And it's got some weird things about it. We mentioned it very briefly in passing last week because it was just something that was out, but not we didn't actually have like the app update that you needed to update the firmware yet. As of this point, I've turned all three of my Circle 2 cameras onto HomeKit Secure Video. And I published two stories so far beyond the news story that we published about just the news of it being out there. And the first one is just about using HomeKit Secure Video and sort of what it's like, what we expected, what's different than what we expected, you know, how it works. And so there's the basic things that I already knew. Like you've got to have a home hub to sort of drive the experience because it uses sort of the recognition objects that it uses. It runs on either the iPad or the Apple TV or the HomePod. So you've got to have a home hub for the feature to work. It's free if you pay for a 2 terabytes for $10 a month, and that includes the 5 cameras, or if you pay for the 200 gigabyte plan, yeah, you get 1 camera, and that's the only option. You can't, like, you know, add more, configure more, or you know, so there's that 5 limit on the big plan and 1 limit on the smaller plan, and then it's not included with the 50 gigabyte 99 cent a month plan. So that's all, you know, we knew that, Eufy, Logitech, and Intapmo were committed to support the features from what Apple said at WWDC. And that it doesn't count against your iCloud storage. So even though it requires a higher tier of iCloud storage to have 1 or up to 5 cameras on your, you know, with your account, it doesn't actually save video that counts against your iCloud storage. So there's nowhere looking in your iCloud storage and say this is how much it's using, because it's using none of it, which is cool.
And it doesn't save like the full day, right? It only saves if it detects motion.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I suppose if like there was motion the whole time, but that's not what you're going for. You don't want to record your empty house. You want to record the house when there's motion detected. And
the only thing you could say there is that some cameras do let you record the whole day because you don't trust the algorithms to necessarily catch motion in some cases.
Sure,
if you had like a car fly past in the very edge of your vision, you might not want to be notified about it, but you might still want to record it. Say if like the police came around a week later saying, "We noticed there was car theft on this road, can you help us?"
Yeah.
And you go, "Oh no, I've turned that bit off.
Yeah.
For instance. Or, "Oh no, my camera didn't actually notice the car in the very, very small corner, but if it actually had a different camera system that just recorded all day long and kept like a rolling 30-day window of video, then that could actually be helpful."
Yeah, and I haven't like looked in or written or researched like a big comparison of this, but my feeling is that most smart cameras that have like iOS apps attached, they default to only detecting motion, because if you're using their cloud service, they don't want you to record everything, and it's kind of so kind of weird or creepy. And so motion is like a middle ground where you record the important parts if you trust their algorithm, and you're not using all of their, you know, more capacity on the servers than you need to. And there are some, like the first HomeKit camera that came out was the D-Link Omna 180 HD, and it includes an SD card slot or micro SD card slot, and you can record to that. But even so, I guess because of like the size of those things, you know, maybe it was different with like VHS tapes and, you know, like local drives, but with like a miniature card, then you don't get that same benefit. But I think it's pretty status quo for these to be just the motion detection, and then you can choose to identify, I think, any motion. So there's people that it can detect, there are cars that it can detect, and animals. So pets are just like animals in the wild. So it's not just any motion. It's supposed to be those three, and there's even icons for like identifying what it thinks it triggered. And some people
and the analysis of the video happens on your home hub. So
correct,
your, like spare iPad or your HomePod,
or your Apple TV.
Apple servers do not see the video stream at all. It's stored end to end encrypted, so you can only view it on your own devices. It doesn't go, like, the only thing that's stored in the server is like a big jumbled encrypted mess that they can't decode anywhere because they don't have the key.
Yeah, and that's what really appeals to me. And one of the big surprises in this is that when you, at least with Logitech and how this works, and I'll just put out a warning here. I mean, Logitech calls this a beta feature. Our friends on the Connected podcast on Relay, they had a very bad experience with this, at least Federico and Steven. So it's not for everybody yet, but I totally consider myself in the camp of people who it is for, which is anything HomeKit is better than non-HomeKit, and you're okay with like testing from 1.0 and beyond and like noticing all the changes and feature improvements over the years. But so I've changed and I've got no regrets. But what I did not expect was that when you add your Circle 2 camera to HomeKit Secure Video, because Logitech cameras, Circle 2s, have worked with HomeKit for a long, long time. But you've also been able to use the Logitech app to see your video, including on Android and the web, which is...
And use their cloud service.
And you can use a free 24 hours of video on their cloud service, or you can pay monthly to have more time than that. Like, I think you can probably go over the 10 days if you pay, but they called it Circle Safe. And then that also had some more features, like you could do if you pay... Then you could unlock features like motion zone and say only pay attention to this area of the view and not this area, and more on that in a moment. But when you add your Circle 2 camera from to HomeKit Secure Video, unlike with just HomeKit as a supported feature, HomeKit Secure Video literally like sucks the camera out of the Logitech app and it's only viewable and controllable in the home app from Apple. So you need an iPhone or an iPad or an iPod Touch to sort of configure all this. And you couldn't do it from just a Mac, for example. You can see it there later, but you can't set it up from the Mac. And that means that like device specific features have to be in the home app now. And that's true. So before, there were a lot of very specific, like camera-specific features that were not in the home app because all it was for was just to stream. And then if you had on the camera, like I think every camera that worked with HomeKit has a motion sensor too. And so you could have an alert set up for motion and then view the live stream optionally, but it wouldn't record anything. It was all recorded through whatever the company that makes the camera is doing. Now it's recorded, it's processed from your home hub to even decide to detect the motion, and then it's encrypted and it's stored in iCloud, but it doesn't kind of get your storage. But you cannot see that camera anymore on the Logitech iOS app. And it's gone from there. When I added the third camera, my app was a login screen to set up a new camera as if I were like a day one customer. And I was... They tell you about that. They tell you you've got to cancel your subscription if you already pay for Logitech Circle Safe, and you'll no longer receive updates through the Logitech app. They'll come from Logitech through the home app. But it really feels like the Logitech camera becomes Apple's hardware because you use the home app for the first time to control the status lights. So, for example, there's always been an option to turn off the LED ring on the camera, which is sort of, it's on by default, and there's a new color scheme of what the lights mean. But I always keep those off because they're just sort of, I don't like LED lights anyway. And also they're like, it's less sort of secret that the camera's there. Not to be like secret, but like if you're breaking in, you don't want a light saying this is a security camera. It's best to have it sort of obscure. And then you also control whether or not you use night vision. So night vision is like if there's a certain low level of light detected, it switches to black and white, and it can see things much better than if it were just like in color, but very, very dark. That's all through the home app now. And that feels cool. Like before, the first time I realized that you could view the video feed of the Logitech cameras on the web, it felt a little bit weird. Like in a web browser, you can view this stuff if you have the right URL I guess login credentials. But now they warn you, you can't use these with the Android anymore. You can't use these with our iOS app anymore, and you certainly can't use them on the web. And that's the part where I feel like it's kind of awesome because suddenly it is encrypted through iCloud, and the motion is processed on your devices, then it's right in the name, HomeKit Secure Video. It just means that Apple's home app has to support the kind of features that the camera makers were doing on their own. Like, for example, there was a feature for Logitech. If you had even the free service, you didn't pay for more cloud storage, you could have a time-lapse video that you watch to see all the motion captured throughout the day. So it's different points in the day, but it's all there and it's very fast and you can sort of review everything that way. And Apple's home app doesn't allow that yet. And that's kind of like a feature that you'd add later on, not on day one. But other features include you can't do one of those motion maps anymore where you say, don't look at the windows of the home, just look at the insides of the home that are not what I'm drawing in, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that kind of stuff is really important for, like, doorbells.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Logitech circles aren't doorbells, but they're not going to suddenly get a feature that, like, when the HomeKit Secure Video Doorbells come along, they're not going to get... it's going to be the same UI as what you get for the circle.
Yeah.
And people want to be able to draw, like, record motion on my driveway in that rectangle. Like, if something's happening at the neighbor's house just because it's in the field of view of the camera, I don't care about it.
Right.
And at the moment, the home app does not support, you know, drawing those rectangles.
Yeah, and it's on every camera these days. So for it to not be in the home app is notable. I think it's acceptable because it is early days for this feature, and surely they will add to it, hopefully, in future iOS 13 updates. But it's something that you've got to be okay with losing if you use that already. And you can say, like, for an outdoor camera, you can say only detect people and pets and not cars, and that gets you part of the way. But it would be nice to be notified that there is a car in your driveway if you aren't home, but ignore the road. You know, that's something I'd want to know at least. So you can't do that yet. The other thing that's kind of weird is that in the Logitech app, you've always been able to select between 720p HD or 1080p full HD. And the idea there is there are a lot of times where you'd have a very bad experience, even if your internet was sort of okay with 1080p, but switching to the lower resolution made it much better. And if you've got a bad connection, especially on mobile, then having a lower resolution video, you know, feed is good. And with the home app, it defaults to 1080p and there's no option to change it. So it's a basic feature that they can add in the future because the camera can support it. The home app should also add the option because you could do it before and you can't now. And the same is true for like the perspective. So I think the Logitech app will let you do like a super wide view, or if you wanted like a less distorted view, you could do just like a standard view and you'd see less stuff, but it was more like, you know, what you see in real life, I suppose. And there's a few features like that. I don't think you've been able to try this feature outright, but just from looking at it, it was, and people who have tried it, I've had people ask me, how do you go back and look at the clips that have been recorded? And for me, like, I guess I've got a high tolerance for this stuff, and as long as I can find that it's okay, but in comparison to what other apps do, I can see where it is kind of tacked on to the existing UI and it's not the most friendly. So there's some issues there. And then, you know, one of the things that Stephen Hackett reached out to me on over the weekend about was that he wants to turn his camera off when he's in his office and only have it like literally be turned on to stream or detect motion, you know, and record if he's not in the office. And his home office is like mine, where it's either part of the house or it's detached. In this case, it's detached, but it's close enough that you can't rely on geolocation to control that setting. And it's kind of a weird thing. Before HomeKit Secure Video, you couldn't turn a camera off at all, like in the home app. You had to go through the third-party app to do it, so whatever the camera maker's app is, to have that be a thing, which was like a missing feature in the experience, and it's still the same case if you're not using HomeKit Secure Video. But if you use HomeKit Secure Video, because Apple needs to have the controls for the camera and not rely on the camera maker's app, they do now have an off option, but it's just when you're home or you're away. It's not any other condition, and you can't address the camera directly with Siri or with a tile for toggling it on and off, you know, like you can other things, and you can't make it part of a scene.
Can't put like camera on, camera off in a scene.
Correct. Or an automation, anything like that. So, and I guess before, like, because there was no off option, it was acceptable. But now that there is an option, I think they need to expose that very soon.
Yeah, that's almost like a privacy issue as well.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Yeah, totally. And so my solution, I didn't want to leave Stephen hanging. So my solution was you can, because I just from experience, you can unplug these things and plug them back into the wall and they just, you know, their power is interrupted, they turn off, and you plug them back in and they catch up. There's no button to press or like, you know, menus to go through. It works. And so you can connect them to a smart plug. And so you can name that your camera or whatever, and you can say turn it on, turn it off. And the smart plugs can be addressed by scenes and can be attached to automations. Like if you've got a motion sensor that isn't the camera, then you could have that, you know, if it detects motion every so often, then have the camera on or turn off after a certain period of time. Or just work hours. You want the camera off during work hours and on outside of work hours. You can do things like that. So, or press a button. You know, you can do those buttons that you, you know, put on a wall or your desk and you press once for one, you know, action or scene, and you press twice or long press for, you know, two or three other options. So, but you shouldn't have to connect a HomeKit smart plug to these things to have that option. Yeah. This should be built in. Yeah,
basics like the motion zones, turning the camera off with some sort of automation, they should be high priority additions. Like, whether they will be is an open question, but that's the kind of stuff that's like essentially required when your third party app becomes useless if you start using HomeKit Secure Video.
Yep. And, you know, I'm very positive on this. Again, I say, you know, people that are used to using another system, whether it's Logitech or whatever camera comes next, then maybe wait a while and like listen to people like me and see how it's going. But it's weird that you've got to contact customer service through Logitech to revert to the old firmware. I guess they send you something to revert, or you send them your camera, they send you another one. I don't know, but there's no going back yet, and maybe that's part of the beta. In the future, you can. But to me, I kind of like that. It's like once you're secure, you know.
And it's quite nice for the peace of mind of like, you know, I'm trusting Apple only with my video stream, and yeah, I know they're going to encrypt it or whatever. And like the fact that all of the other Logitech features just completely disabled gives you that sensibility of, oh, okay, you know, I'm going into this thing for the secure aspect of this, mm-hmm. you know, that's a big part of it, and everything else doesn't work anymore, so I should be pretty good on the security front.
Yep, and we didn't expect that, you know. Maybe we thought that you could do HomeKit Secure Video, and so on the HomeKit side it's good, but then you can also
I don't think we know like for definite yet that if that's going to apply to every accessory.
If it's intentional or not, right?
Yeah, like maybe the RAM requirements and the memory limits of the Logitech Circle camera is just too constrained, so they have to do it like one or the other. But Apple hasn't said or decreed anywhere that you must disable every other feature. I just think that's currently how the circles are implemented.
And also, much of what we know about how firmware updates will come out and the new color guide and those things, you know, we go back to documentation. Logitech has documented way more about HomeKit Secure Video than what Apple has documented. Whether it's through an FAQ or they've got people on the project who are writing on the forum, so they've got their community forum and they're answering questions. So much of what we know officially comes from a user named Logi Aaron or Aaron Logi, and he worked on the project or they worked on the project, and so we know a lot of these things because of that person, including, you know, once it gets sucked into the Home app, you've never before been able to update firmware for anything but Apple's products through the Home app. So, and that only applies to the HomePod. Apple TV is its own thing. iPad hubs, they're their own thing. So, and every other thing requires you to go to their app, and they link the app from the Home app, including Logitech Circle now, even though it doesn't apply. And they even give you notifications for firmware updates that are available, but you've still got to follow through to the app to do those. And now with HomeKit Secure Video cameras, it has to come from Apple. And they don't talk about how they're going to do this. You know, for all I know, it would be that Logitech gives firmware to Apple and then Apple approves it because they want to control the experience. But from what they've written on the forums on Logitech's side, Logitech will do updates for Circle through the Circle app on their own, as they always have done. And Logitech HomeKit Secure Video cameras through the Home app will check nightly for updates. And if there's something available, it will apply it overnight. And so, and it'll be automatic. And I don't think there'll be like a UI for it, except for seeing your version number. And then I don't think there'll be like an update screen, update manually. I think it'll be, which is true for Logitech before, you didn't go and look for the update. It was just available to you, and you got it when you got it. But it would be nice if more of this was documented for customers, just to say, you know, how will you have future updates, you know? And probably like it's the Home app that gets updated through iOS updates that gives you new features. But if Logitech needs to put out a security update, you know, to patch a bug, you'd want to know about that, and you'd want to be able to apply it as soon as possible, whether you're using one or the other, even if HomeKit's
security. Or if there was a disaster case where an update started bricking your cameras, a la the HomePod update that was bricking the HomePods.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if you could turn off software updates temporarily in the Home App UI somewhere.
Right. That was the last message between me and Steven over the weekend was he said, I can't wait for iOS 14 beta to break all of our cameras. Like, yeah, I know. So, again, it's like it comes with a big disclaimer of Logitech calls it a beta, Apple doesn't, but expect this experience. And I'm glad that I've gotten to get, I've been able to write about it both from the using it side and also this is what's missing that Apple needs to bring to the table in the future side. I'm happy with it because I used to pay for Logitech Circle stuff. So you got more than one day of motion stuff, but it's like $10 a month or so. And so for something that you don't necessarily need, it wasn't something that I wanted to pay for every month, so I canceled it. And then I would only have the stuff for one day, and I didn't like going to another app to do that, and so I barely ever use that feature. And now it's on every version of the Home app except for the Watch, including the Mac. And so I can just go through, look at the live feed, then look at the clips that have been recorded, and it's kind of neat. Like this morning, I saw that I arrived home from taking the kids to school and daycare at 7:39. And I knew that my wife was leaving for work some point, but I thought maybe I'd make it back before she arrived. And then I was curiously looking at the clips of like what had been captured. And I realized that it was 6 minutes before I arrived that she had left for work. And I was like, we just missed each other. And I had no idea. We probably passed each other on the road. But I'm seeing those things just because it's part of the Home app now, and you get those 10 days of clips and not just 24 hours.
Yeah. I think it's great. Like,
yep.
Yes, there are some obvious missing features, but for the first version, the first go, I think it's pretty good. Pretty respectable.
Yeah, Stephen had a legitimate concern that, Logitech and Nest and Canary and whoever else is making security cameras for home, that their business involves making new features and pushing them out as soon as possible and being competitive.
And getting subscription revenue.
And subscription revenue. And right. And my friend David Sparks from Mac Power Users, I mean, he even told me when he was asking about these before they came out, his fear was that anyone who uses a subscription service to boost revenue from the one-time sale of hardware, that they just wouldn't be interested in supporting HomeKit Secure Video. And then it turns out that Logitech was the first to do it, and they do have that subscription service. So I think
that... Well, here's the backstop for that, right? Yeah. Apple's building all this stuff into the Home app. Say if all of the third-party cameras give up, Apple could just make a very simple camera, and
yeah,
they've already got everything in place.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. So that's cool. But I sort of share the same concern that Stephen has, even if some of these companies are part of bigger companies like Amazon or Google. But I think that given, our positions as podcast host and writers of blogs with audiences, that it's sort of on us to hold Apple accountable for saying like, hey, this isn't great enough yet, or this could be better. We like it, but let's improve it. And that's just how we'll kind of go for a little while. And then hopefully they'll be competitive in the long term. And in my piece, I did write that the fear here is that Apple is the private solution, but the basic solution. And so you've got to give up basic features for privacy, and that would be a shame because you wouldn't win. You wouldn't be able to use the good stuff. So we'll see how it goes. All of this did make me wonder one thing, which is on I think it was like the first week of January that Netatmo had showed off at WWDC their HomeKit video doorbell, and it's one that has the micro SD slot. And then no cost recording to that, so you don't have to pay a subscription. But I think they promised to release this year, and the year's coming to an end soon.
They said full, yeah.
Yeah, so we have seen the Robin Telecom Company sell a really ugly and several hundreds of dollars worth doorbell that I will never use because of how it looks and how expensive it is.
I have one because they sent one to me.
Oh, I'm sorry to be so offensive then.
But... I'll tell you this: I have not put it up on the on the front door yet.
It's not so.
It's been sitting on my table for months, and I would like to use it, but it is pretty big, pretty ugly, and obviously I'm going to have to get like an electrician around to actually get it fitted and stuff. Mm. So, and if it was sleeker, I'd probably be more enticed to do it.
If it wasn't $500 or $600 too, that's a big factor.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I didn't have to pay for it, so that was I certainly wouldn't have bought it if it was my own money.
Yeah. So I wonder where the Natapmu doorbell camera is. I don't think you can even buy it yet, much less use HomeKit with it, much less use HomeKit secure video with it.
It is missing in action.
It's missing in action. So I just want to float that out there. The year isn't over yet. Neither is fall, but this isn't out there yet. But speaking of Natapmu, they did release the weather station update for HomeKit support a few weeks ago, and we both received one to test. And you've written about the experience of both that launching, you caught the news story, and then also actually using it around your house. So I wanted to take an opportunity to sort of discuss that for the first time now that we've both been able to use those, and then go from there. So what's your experience been? What did you write about in your review?
Yeah, so the sensors, like, how much can you say about, you know, sensor sticks, right? It's just a little box that tracks all sorts of statistics. And there are a few different ones that exist on the market that work with HomeKit before. I think this is your best option. It has a lot of metrics in two relatively small little cylinders. One goes on the inside in an indoor room and one goes outside. And you can get humidity, temperature, noise levels, rainfall, all of this stuff can be plugged in to this weather station. The only shortcomings are where you come to the HomeKit side of the equation, in that at least a few of the features that the weather stations do support in their own apps do not translate currently into the HomeKit world, just because either the protocols aren't there or they're not included in the standard, like those type of accessories aren't available. But the company says they're committed to supporting more over time. From the ones that do work, like temperature and humidity and air quality, and they even have like a CO2 measurement, I've been very, very happy with it. It updates quickly in the home app. It doesn't, you know, sit on that updating ... screen for a long time. The temperature readings seem accurate. The humidity readings seem accurate. The only one I've had slight confusion with is the indoor air quality. It keeps telling me that my indoor air quality is inferior. And you get like the annoying notifications about it. I'm pretty sure the room's fine, and it's just like bugging out on that one. But apart from that one sensor, everything else is great. It updates really fast. I feel like the company is committed to HomeKit, and I have confidence that when, you know, the Home app does add support for things like noise levels, that it will update in kind. These sensors would be terrible in the pre iOS 13. in the iOS 13 and iOS 13.1 days, where you couldn't ungroup the tiles because the group version of the tiles is really, really bad.
I finally converted.
But thankfully, in 13.2 and 13.3, you can ungroup the tiles into their separate statistics, and it's, you get dynamic information, and it works great.
It isn't the default, but it can be fixed. It can be remedied. Yep. I've got the Eve Weather, which is an outdoor sensor that works with HomeKit, and it's got a coin battery that you replace to you know, keep it powered. And actually, I think the newest one has it. You just charge it. I think this might be how it works. But and it's got an e-ink screen on it, so you can see the temperature, the air quality, and the humidity. And you can sort of like tap through a little button to change which one is visible. Or in the app, you can obviously see all three, including in the Home app. And I love this thing. Like I'm a weather nerd. I used to want to be a weatherman when I was like 10. And, you know, I always like seeing the houses that have like the thermometer gauge, like outside, where it's like the red liquid and it shows the temperature, on like a little, like a, you know, container. And this is like the modern version of that, where outside of my front door, I have the temperature, and neighbors and visitors and like delivery people have always commented on like, that's cool. That's neat that you can see the temperature there. And for me, it's also like, you've got the weather data from your weather app for your zip code, but I can also see like, what is the temperature and humidity at my front door? And it's usually a little bit different. So I like that. The Natapmu stuff, just looking at the outdoor sensor, I put them in the same place because Natapmu wants to be covered outside and not where it will get wet or be in direct sunlight to sort of mess with the temperature reading. So I've got it in the same location by my front door, except you can't read the data on the sensor itself, so it's not there. You've got to look at it in the app to see. So it doesn't have that same effect of being like, this is your temperature gauge for viewing. It's just for measuring. And I've found that it's usually about 2 degrees off for temperature from what the eve weather is doing. And I don't know which one is more accurate, but, you know, it's kind of put it in between. And then a few percentage points off for humidity. And so it's somewhere in the ballpark of like what's in between those two. So I like that. The air quality thing for indoors, that's part of HomeKit. For the first maybe like 2 weeks, I didn't have an issue with that. But then lately I have. And I haven't done enough research yet on what you should expect for your, CO2 parts per million number to be.
Mm-hmm.
But if you hit 1,000, then that's inferior, I believe. And you don't get an alert from the Home app, but you do get an alert from the Tapmo's app. And if you hit 2,000 or over, you get an alert from the Tapmo and from the Home app. And it's like you've got abnormal air quality. And I've not done enough research on like what you need to do to keep it under that. I did read something that said like most offices are under 600. And this is my living room that I'm sensing. So I don't know, you know, if it's an issue or not. But I've also read that
for me right now, my indoor sensor is in the living room, and the carbon dioxide reading on the home inside the Home app is 859 parts per million. But then separately, the indoor air quality is flashing as inferior.
That's odd. Well, yeah. I also read that, like, in cars with lots of people inside the car, you can have like 6,000 or over, and I guess, you know, it's not deadly. It's just not unpleasant. So the only thing I've done is like it's a good time of the year right now to open the windows and like air out the house. So I've done that. I don't think it has an effect that I can see. But I did have to go and disable the alert both from the Tapmo and from the Home app because it was just it was often enough that it was inactionable for me so far without more learning and research that it just wasn't informative yet. And I think that's a part of this where like the Home app itself ignored the Tapmo, but the Home app should be informative about this is a sensor that can detect things and also tell you why you should like what you need to know about that. And they've done that in the Health app where they didn't from the get-go, but then they've made it really good over time to where you can learn a lot about what's being, you know, captured in the Health app or what you put in the Health app. The Home app needs that sort of treatment where, you know, you've got explainers on what even is air quality, you know, what even is CO2 levels. Like, why does it matter?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I guess they sort of rely on, like, if you bought this, then you already know, but that just isn't the case.
And I do think it's telling that both me and you have had issues with the air quality alert things. So,
yeah.
Maybe there is a hardware problem there.
Yeah. I do have, one of the cameras that I have, the Arlo Baby camera. You know, that one that can have, optionally have ears. It has a bunch of sensors on it too. And so I can see in my son's room what the air quality is there. You don't see CO2 though. So you don't get that exact number. And the same for the office. I've got the Eve room, I think it's called. And I can see humidity and air quality being excellent there. So I guess we both need to do more research on this and then also, you know, see if this is an issue for a lot of other people. But first thing I want to know is what do you do? Like, what are factors that make the CO2 higher? And then what can you do about it? And then also, what does it mean? So if it makes your air quality inferior, like, does that mean it's stuffy or, you know, is it, you know, what is it? So,
yeah, is it actually damaging to your health or is it just slightly uncomfortable?
Yep. And the last thing I'd like to see is because it does measure the indoor sensor, it measures noise and decibels that, and because Apple has that in the Health app as a metric, you know, through either headphones or the Apple Watch Series 4 or 5, then having that in the Home app would be cool. And you can get alerts from the Tapmo on, it's loud in here, you know, and it's like uncomfortably loud. And so, you know, if you can control that, you should. But it's not in the Home app yet. And I think that'd be very cool to see just as like the, you know, the 45 decibels, 60 decibels, whatever it is, as a metric. Just the more data that you can capture, the more data you should present. And Apple's obviously shown an interest in you know, that category. So putting it in the Home app would be neat. One last thing to discuss this week is a little bit weird, but we've talked about it before, and it's with the Apple TV Plus service at large, which is that The Banker is supposed to be Apple's first film in theaters, which is important because to receive nominations and consideration for awards, you need to have a theatric release of movies. And we've already, you know, seen stories that say Apple wants to receive those awards, so they will be premiering some movies in theaters before they reach the streaming service. And their first film is called The Banker. It has some big name stars in it, and it's unclear if it will be released in theaters or the streaming service yet. So what's happening there, Mio?
Yeah, so it was meant to be premiering at a film festival today, but literally one day before, Apple had to cancel it at very, very short notice because they received information about allegations of a sexual nature against the protagonist's son. So in the film, the character is Bernard Garrett. And so that's what the film centers around, that character. And then in the actual story is based on real life. It's meant to be based on true events. So one of the producers of the film is Bernard Garrett's son, Bennett Garrett Jr. And he is now facing, and he was a co-producer of The Banker up until like the fifth, when his name started getting disappeared. He was supposed to be going on the press tours and stuff, but he didn't show. And now what it turns out is that he's facing allegations from his half-sisters about sexual misconduct of quite a serious nature. Now, obviously, it's only allegations, but they've come up. And that was enough to get the film temporarily withheld from release. There was also a complaint that his involvement in the film contorted the timeline of events such that it would leave the girls and their mother out of the story. So even though it's meant to be about, you know, a real family, potentially the timeline has been changed to hide, you know, maybe what was really going on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the situation. Obviously, it's not great, but it's not confirmed, or, you know, it's just allegations at this point. That's true. But just because there's even with allegations, it's enough for Apple to at least put the film temporarily on hold. And they have delayed premiering at the film festival, which means it's unlikely to air in theatres, and it was meant to be airing in theatres from December the 6th. So it seems very unlikely that it's going to be in theatres on the 6th at this point. The question is, what do they do about it? So do they never release the film at all? Do they release the film only on Apple TV Plus and not do it in theatres as more of like a subdued launch? Or do they do something where it comes into theatres at a delayed date and then it comes to TV Plus after, because you need to have the exclusivity window for, you know, awards consideration?
Yeah.
I think this whole situation just kind of underlines the inherent issues with content production, and it exposes a flaw in Apple's strategy towards original content, where obviously they have a very small slate of titles at the moment and in development. And if they were a traditional network, what would happen is the film would get bumped and a different film would be pushed up and ready to go. But in this situation, Apple doesn't have another film finished. They have Hala, which is coming out, right? That's mm-hmm. being released on the 6th. But for a film for January, which is when this was meant to be launching on TV Plus at least, they don't have anything. All their other films in development are not finished yet. So, you know, up to now, they were kind of promising a film in January, and now it's probably not going to happen. Even if the film's not entirely cancelled, it seems the delay will at least push it past January. So it's a problemo.
Yeah. If this was like Apple's third or fifth or 10th or 30th film, it wouldn't be a big story. I mean, it would be dramatic, but it wouldn't be like what it is because of it being the first film in theaters. They consider The Elephant Queen to be a film and not a TV series because it's a documentary, you know, 90 minutes or so. But that wasn't the one for award consideration in theaters. And
at least at a big scale. Like, they did show it in some theaters, but not to the degree that The Banker was going to be. And The Banker obviously features, you know, big celebrities,
mm-hmm.
and the other films don't.
Right. And so the it's all like just pretty dramatic. It was the American Film Institute, which is a very big deal, that the grand finale of their film festival this year was supposed to be The Banker from Apple TV Plus. And it was like the last thing that they showed as like the grand finale. And because it was pulled the night before, then there was a big hole there. And so they had to, I think Netflix offered up one of their films to show instead. And so they had something for the festival. But that just shows like the nature of how abrupt this all happened, you know? And then, you know, we've had, at first the story was just, this is in general, there's an issue with the film. We didn't know specifically what, and then the Hollywood Reporter, I think, was first to have the specific details about exactly what happened, at least from the allegation perspective. And because it's not one of the characters that are part of the true story, I think it's less severe, but because it's the son of one of them and they were influential in telling the story, and they obviously have, you know, if the allegations are true, they've got this, you know, they're not going to be honest about the other family's involvement, and it's a true story or based on a true story, then that just changes the whole film. And Apple gave a response to this, right? Like they said, you know,
We purchased The Banker early this year as we were moved by the film's entertaining and educational story about social change and financial literacy. Mm-hmm. Last week, some concerns surrounding the film were brought to our attention. We, along with the filmmakers, need some time to look into these matters and determine the best next steps.
Yeah, so it's not dead yet. And like, there's some news coverage that's saying that they like pulled their first film, but it was just the premiere at the film festival. It wasn't from the theatrical release date yet, and so it's still to be. That's kind of a question mark now. Like you mentioned, what will happen there? Will their first film not be released as planned, and will it not be released on the streaming service? And you know, how will it all go? And sort of as we learned details, we felt differently about what they could even possibly do. You know, at first we thought they can't even air this; they'll be torn apart. And you know, I was kind of like zooming out and looking at this stuff and thinking like, you know, has Apple had to deal with this before? Because it is messy to be involved with Hollywood, especially with the you know, something based on true events, because then, you know, you've only know what you're working with, and this kind of stuff can happen where at the last
within
minute,
a month of the service launching.
Yeah, this could happen. You know, we talked about, you know, me and you offline, if it was sort of fiction, then they'd be at less risk here if they were trying to avoid this sort of thing, from like lessons learned over the past few years. But even then, there's you know, one of the big things with Harvey Weinstein is he's the producer of many films, including fiction, and then, you know, his name gets attached to these movies, and so there could always be drama with the director or the producer or one of the actors in the movie, you know. So that doesn't totally keep them out of risk here. So it's an issue, and their like flagship TV show on the service is about the Me Too movement in many, many ways, and sort of about this storyline of like how things of a sexual nature can be, you know, it's something that can be unknown and spoken about.
Yeah, manipulated and controlled and silenced. Like,
exactly.
That's their premiere show.
Yeah.
The morning show.
Yeah. And then in this movie, there were allegations that the son of the protagonist, as you said, could be manipulating the true story and how it's told to totally remove the mother and the two half sisters that should have been involved in the film. And then one of them is very unhappy about the film at all, that it's not a good thing to be released. So, surely not what Apple wanted with their first movie for theaters and you know, that comes to the service. We'll see how it gets resolved.
Yeah, like they were riding this in a big way.
Yeah.
The star power, like Samuel L. Jackson, Anthony Mackie, they're, you know, they're big names. Like, no offense to Halal, I'm sure it's a fine film, but if Halal had like sexual allegations against it, they'd probably just pull the film immediately and move on, because it's a nice film, but it doesn't have the you know, the Hollywood power associated with it in any way.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a small like film that aired at Sundance that was cool when they bought it. This has, you know, they didn't pioneer the story. Obviously they did purchase it, but it has, you know, big names attached to it. So it's more of a conundrum for them. Like, them shelving that is a bigger waste for them.
I mean, right. There has been some drama around Halal, right? Like with the trailer, some people were not happy.
Yeah, there's Muslim, like the Muslim community has had a fair amount of backlash against the Halal trailers and stuff. So they're not completely out of the woods there either.
Well, you know, and so in thinking about, you know, does Apple's involvement in TV series and film productions, does that put them in a messy spot that they've not experienced before? And you think about it, it's like with music, they've had to do something that Spotify and others have had to do, which is you know, you can serve up the music and just say the music is what it is, and if you don't like it, don't add it to your library, or don't buy it. I don't know that they've ever pulled music from the store, maybe. But they've at least had to do something proactively, which is eliminate the human curation and including certain artists, like R. Kelly, for example, for sexual allegations, from playlists. So you don't want to promote the music at all in the editorial side. From the podcast side, you know, they've not only, you know, not considered promotion through editorial stuff, but actually like removed the iTunes link to subscribe to something like Alex Jones and his podcast, you know, where you can still listen to it on the internet, but not through iTunes, not through Apple Podcast. So it's just an RSS feed, but they're not going to promote it or even include it in their app. And then in the App Store, I mean, there's stuff where all kinds of categories are become problematic, you know, or they were okay at one point, now they're not okay.
So, I mean, just this week they had the vaping thing where they've pulled a lot of vaping apps that are, you know, technically not illegal, but now frowned upon by some health communities, and people are upset about that.
Yeah. So with that
perspective, and that's an editorial choice at the end of the day.
Exactly. So with that perspective, if it's one thing if like the government says you have to take this action, then they can say our hands were tied, or, you know, no comment and just apply, you know, we're obliged. But in this case, you know, it's not a pro. You know, at first you think TV's messy and this could have been avoided if they just didn't bother with this whole service. But zooming way out, I think that it's inherent with anything culture, you know, human, like when they've got a human side to it with curation and editorial, then it's bound to happen. And so with that perspective, I feel a little better about it, and not just that, like, what is Apple getting into here? They were totally blindsided. You know, they should have known this was going to happen, because it can't apply in other forms and other, you know, sort of services and media, you know, sources that they have. So,
yeah. And personally, I would like it if the film was released, because I was, you know, looking forward to watching it. But I can understand that when you're the biggest company in the world with a lot of money, a lot of influence, and a lot of power, it could be a very bad look to release it. With, you know, given the severity of the claims.
Yeah, it's tainted now, right? Like, you can't look at it and just feel good about it. There's and they could include, before the film starts, you know, a reference of this, and say, you know, they have something about it to acknowledge it. But it's tricky, and you don't really want that for your first film. So it came out of nowhere, but it's real life, and it's a very real thing. And the last thing in the TV space has nothing to do with that at all. It's about news from like earlier this year. This first happened in July, where CBS All Access became available as an Apple TV channel in the TV app, where you can pay for CBS, the network, and have original content exclusive to the channel and on demand stuff. And, something I didn't realize is also live access to like the CBS channel as it broadcasts live based on your zip code, which your local CBS provider is. And in my case, it's WLOX. And so I can see that channel through the TV app on the iPhone or iPad or Mac or Apple TV. And this came about because Hulu with live TV raised their price from $45 to $55. And I just didn't feel like it was worth it anymore for me. And with adding new services, it felt like it was just too much. And I was looking at what I actually watched. Well, local news is a big one. And how can I get local news without just giving that up or having a digital antenna? And I realized CBS All Access, it has – you can do the local channel stream live through the TV app, which is awesome, because now it's part of the Mac, or even with Hulu, it was a website, not a Mac app. And so I've subscribed to that, and it's sort of filled that void to my $45 bill. You know, I also watch other things. Like, I'm really big into HGTV, the home network channel, and things like that. But, you know, don't have those anymore, but at least I've got my local news and then some sports. And then you told me that CBS – well, one thing before I go there. I also didn't realize that with HBO as the Apple TV channels feature, when you pay for HBO through Apple, that you get the live channel too, of like whatever they're airing on the West or East Coast. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's so buried in the TV app. It's like the bottom of all the on-demand stuff.
Yeah, the UI is really bad.
Yeah. but then I knew that about HBO after using it. And then it was true for CBS All Access as well. And then you told me that CBS All Access is one that you can actually take your Apple TV channel subscription and turn that into like a login credentials for the service anywhere, including the web or the iOS app or the Apple TV app or the Android app. And so I'm doing that too. I'm paying through Apple, and I get the stuff through the TV channels, you know, feature within the TV app, but I'm also using the CBS app on everything, including my Samsung TV without an Apple TV. And then
there's no downside.
There's no downside.
You subscribe to every two channels. It's the same price, and you can access everything that you could if you bought it just through the CBS app. Mm-hmm. Plus, it's inside the TV app natively.
Yep.
This is the only channel that supports this right now that I know of. All the other Apple TV channels, like HBO, if you subscribe through the TV app, you cannot use that login elsewhere.
Yeah.
So you are trapped inside the TV app, which is a downside in some cases. So CBS is the only ones that I know of to date that actually supports logging in with the Apple TV channel subscription to the normal apps.
Yep. And because I'm using it for live TV primarily, because I want to watch the news in real time through CBS, then I am using it that way through their apps a lot of times because it's so buried. I have to go down from the TV app home screen or, you know, the first screen of the app to find the channel section and then find CBS All Access as one of my channels and then go to the bottom of that screen to see the live TV tile. So it's not fast. I don't think Siri can help with this. So, but what I can do is go to the CBS app and then from the top, you know, menu bar up there or like the tabs of options, navigation menu, and then live TV is one of those things. And so it's like a couple of clicks and not like a bunch of digging around. So I'm happy with that. And then the icing on the cake is that there's actually a lot of stuff on CBS that I like, including my local morning news and evening news, including like 60 Minutes. I watch that every week. I used to do the podcast audio version if I couldn't watch it on TV or DVR it. Face the Nation in the morning, Sunday morning is like a sort of like a not news but like informational show that I like and I've watched since I was a kid. So all of that stuff I've got plugged into the TV app up Next Queue. And so as episodes of like the news airs or those weekly shows that I watch airs, they're part of my up Next Queue now. And if I didn't watch them live, I can watch them on demand. And I really like it. So
yeah, that is cool.
Yeah, I wish that other networks had this the same way as CBS. And honestly, like what I expected from CBS was that it's you pay for it to have access to Star Trek originals and Twilight Zone, and that is true. But there's also like all the other stuff that used to air or airs now, plus the live stuff. So I'm happy with that. And thanks to you for telling me about the login situation because that does help for live TV especially. Yep. All right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. If you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. If you enjoy the show, give us a rating in a podcast or recommend us in Overcast or wherever you listen to podcasts. Share the podcast with a friend or family. We really appreciate that. And you can follow us. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZac. That's APOLLOZAC. And Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
All right. And also, I want to say one thing about my other podcast, 9 to 5 Mac Watch Time. So it's been going on since like the summer, and I expected it to be about 8 episodes and then call that a season and wrap it up. And it's gone to 11. And I've looked at my calendar and sort of seeing December is pretty busy. I've decided to not end it because it went longer than I expected, but to just put it on a pause for the month of December. But it will be back in January, I believe, January 1st, and then be every other week from there until we go on another break. But I've had a really good experience so far. I know a lot of the Happy Hour audience tunes in for that as well. If you haven't tried it out yet, you've got like 5 weeks to binge it, all the 11 episodes, including one with you, Mayo, and be caught up for January. So thanks for everyone listening to that. That's again 9 to 5 Mac Watch Time. And so you can find that Apple Podcast or Overcast or wherever. And with all that being said, we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.